This is Vale Farron. And I am driving home. You're gonna hear a big blast of air coming on in a second here. There it is. I may turn that just a little. It is Friday today as opposed to Thursday. I was home all week, working from home, which is honestly not a bad deal. Because that saves me an hour a day. It saves me. I mean, it's really not a bad deal. But you know, you gotta be in the office to have the camaraderie and to have the quick interactions and moving on and all that kind of stuff. And so it's good to be in the office. I was out of the office just as a precaution, because my son-in-law, I probably mentioned this last week, my son-in-law had come down with COVID, positive test, all that good stuff. And everyone who was in close proximity to him, including my wife, has been locked down now for a couple of weeks. And my wife will be in quarantine through Monday. She got a call from the Greene County Health Commission, whatever it is. I have never gotten a call from them, but I went in immediately to talk to the people that I report to at my major client, and I said, here's the situation. Oops, I just scared somebody because I slowed down too fast. Anyways, and they said, you're probably okay, because I had been in their house for like 15 minutes the week before. You're probably okay, but why don't you just work from home for the rest of this week and the rest of next week? And, okay, that's fine. So I've been at home all week working, got a lot of stuff done, you know, you can be pretty productive. But anyways, I am going back on Monday. At least the plan is to go back on Monday. We did have a bit of a scare with my wife because she had a running headache for probably 4 or 5 days. She just couldn't get rid of it. And that was actually the main symptom that my son-in-law had and my daughter, although my daughter had never had a positive test. And he lost his sense of smell. So he had a headache, lost his sense of smell. My beloved had this weird headache that she couldn't get rid of for like 5 days running. So she went ahead and got tested last Monday. Came back negative. And I was really surprised how fast the results came out. She was tested Monday evening, like at 5:50. And I think we had the results the next day. Or maybe 2 days, maybe Thursday. Anyway, so she came back negative. Yay, we were all happy about that. Because my beloved is 63, and she's had some respiratory troubles and borderline diabetic, and I don't think it would be good for her to get it from everything I can see. So she doesn't, though, so good. Which means that I am clear, so. If she had gotten a positive diagnosis, it would have been like, what do we do about costume day now? But I am clear, at least so far. So all is well, all is good. Life is good, that's good. Book is good. I am supposedly landing the book this weekend, book 13, which means that I have an epilogue to write, which is supposed to hit the moment. So, theoretically, this epilogue is going to hit two moments. They're going to come back to back. So we'll see. You never know till you have it on the page. You just never know. It can think right in your head, and you can, think, yeah, that'll work fine. And then when you try to get it on the page, sometimes it just won't go on the page. And it's because you're missing some components. You know, you don't quite have everything tuned correctly. I know I've said this before, but it really is a fascinating thing. How you can put together a string of words and unlock emotion in people. That is just... man. And I really enjoy doing that. It's... yeah. So, anyways, so the writing is good. I am, depending on how you classify this second book of the year, I am either ahead of schedule or on schedule, one of the two. Because typically what happens is I write for 8 weeks, I knock off, write for another weeks, 8 weeks, then I'm done. But the way this second book sprint goes, I usually get about 9 weeks in April and May, the way it falls. So that puts me a week ahead. And then the books are supposed to come in at 150, not 160. So 16 weeks, 10,000 words a week, 160,000. But if the books come in under 160, then I just need a good hard push on 15 weeks, not 16 weeks. And that's been the case with this book, which theoretically means that I can get my order in and get the beta copies to the beta readers before the end of September. Because the second book of the year, I figured out that if I would wait until after Thanksgiving to get people, to get people to turn their books back in, that just wouldn't work. So if I say, give them me your books on December the 1st, I mean, people are into the Christmas holidays at that point. They're just gone. So what I do is that deadline is November the 15th, which means I need to have them in their hands not much later than September the 15th, because I like to give people 2 months to read the book. But then that backs the whole schedule up. But we are here in the third week of August. If all things go well, I should land book 13 this weekend. I should finish up the rough draft, and then I have editing to do, first pass editing. I have a cover to build, yada, yada, yada. Hopefully get them to Amazon to print them first or second week of September. Hopefully it doesn't take them any longer than a week or so, 2 weeks to get them printed. And then we're close to schedule. What I tell people is the beta books will be ready October 1st, and then I try to get at least a week ahead of that. It is International Dog Day today, since this is Friday, not Thursday. And so I am doing this podcast, in case you are wondering what I'm wearing. I am doing this podcast in a poodle suit. It's a poodle cat suit, which is a little weird. I don't, but that's what it's actually called. It is a poodle cat suit. Plus, I am drawing attention to the plight of the pom-pom poodle. The fact that pom-pom poodles, the standard poodles that have been given what is affectionately called the continental cut, where they shave them from their abdomen down to their ankles and make it look like they're wearing a coat and socks and nothing else, and then they parade them around inside auditoriums. I am drawing attention to the fact that we make these poor dogs live the nightmare every day. Hashtag no pants. So that's been fun. People have enjoyed it. I'm actually driving home from Walmart at this point. Made a couple other visits, but people have really, really enjoyed it. And they usually do. I actually made this costume last year. And so I was able to just pull this one out and reuse it, because I'm working on Bowtie Day at this point and Labor Day, and then I have several in a row that are just bought costumes that are going to be easy. And then I don't think I have to... I'm not sure quite what's going on the early weeks of December. So I may have something that I need to put together for there, but I'm, after I get Bowtie Day and Labor Day done, I think I'm pretty well coasting out the rest of the year without fits for every weekend without having to build anything new. So, yay. I am going to have to get the Christmas Story ugly Christmas sweater outfit out at some point and do a little bit of repair on it, but I don't have to build it from scratch. So, anyways, I came across an article, and then I did a little more research on this article, and maybe the theory isn't as interesting, as fun as you might think on first pass, but nonetheless, it was put forth by a writer, and so I'm always interested in writers and who are writing science fiction about the larger scope of humanity's place in the universe and what that might be, since I am engaged in such a project right now. So I always find the ideas interesting. This particular theory is called the Dark Forest theory, and it was put out by, I'm wearing gloves in this dog suit, and so it's very difficult to actually navigate these pages, and apparently someone didn't know where they were going, or I was driving too close to them, or something, they got nervous because they just pulled off and let me pull around, so hopefully I wasn't driving too close. Anyways, so I would get you the name of the person who came up with this, but the gloves are just terrible. So the theory is a reflection on the Fermi paradox. Basically, the Fermi paradox said, look, if there's billions and billions of stars out there, and those stars have planets around them, you would think that some of those planets would be habitable, and that life would just magically appear on these planets, because this all comes from the idea that life is not unique, life is not special, it's just something that happens. Okay, well, if that's what your premise, you know, wants to be, that's fine. It's interesting, because of the Fermi paradox, there have been some people who have adjusted that and have actually come to the point where they say it could be that life is so mind-bogglingly complex and the chance of it arising are so small that maybe we are the only ones. Anyways, the Fermi paradox says, if you've got all those planets out there, if life is going to randomly arise on more than one, where are the aliens? Why haven't we detected aliens yet? Because we've looked and looked and looked, and we find pulsars, we find bleeps, regular bleeps coming across. We find stars that sometimes are dimming and then growing brighter, and we don't have an explanation for that. But then as we go along and do some more checking, and then it's like, well, you know, maybe the star is in this stage of its life, and blah, 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 blah. So maybe it's not what we thought it was, etc. So where are the aliens? That's the big Fermi paradox. So this author came up with something called the Dark Forest theory. And the Dark Forest theory goes something like this. Well, all life desires to stay alive. B, there is no way to know whether life forms will destroy you if given the chance. C, lacking assurances, the safest option for any species is to stay quiet and monitor the others. So the idea here is everybody's hiding. That's really what's happening. Every species that would somehow arise, reach a point where they could listen, every species would end up reaching the same conclusion, and therefore, that's why we don't hear of anybody. So, you know, that's a pretty interesting little thing. And then, of course, the dun-dun-dun. Because as a writer, you're always looking for the dun-dun-dun, you know? And you're always looking for the dun-dun-dun. And so, of course, the dun-dun-dun is, we've already made too much noise, dun-dun-dun, you know, because we didn't know we were supposed to stay quiet. So that's the dark forest theory, and, you know, that's pretty interesting. I did come across another podcast and looking at this where the guy went through the dark forest theory and kind of pointed out some of the issues with it. And as he was going, I was like, yep. Okay, so the name of the author was... his name is CXINLIU. So anyways, and it won the Hugo Award winning trilogy, Remembrance of the Earth Past. So anyways, I mean, there are a couple of problems with this when you start talking about it. Yes, you know, they're in game theory, maybe there would be some that would decide to just hide, but more likely there would be others who would decide to attack first, because you've got the old idea of two prisoners have been arrested, and these two prisoners are put in separate rooms, and the cops walk in and say, you know, we don't have enough evidence to hold you, but if you confess and you implicate your partner, then you'll only get 4 years. If you both don't say anything, of course, you might get off. But if one of you speaks first, you're only going to get 4 years and the other guy is going to get 10 years. So what do you want to do? And so, of course, the idea is if you're going to maximize your potential to spend the least number of years possible, well, then you tell on the other guy, because you don't know what he's going to do. And so the idea there, if you apply to this, is that if you don't know whether you're going to be attacked by others, but you think the idea is high, then instead of sitting around and hiding, what you're going to do is just attack everybody else because you yourself don't want to be attacked. And so then you get into the question of, all right, so I'm taking my gloves off. You get into the question of, is it really plausible that every civilization out there would decide to all hide at the same time? Or are you going to get civilizations that are going to decide they are going to attack first? And the guy goes through actually what is a pretty interesting idea about if you were going to attack. You know, you would just do something like, he says, first off, while hiding is a good strategy, if you can pull it off, you can't pull it off. You can't hide your planet backwards in time. And if I'm a high-tech civilization with spaceflight and automation, I can get away with building huge mega telescopes or even just sending probes to do flybys of every star in the galaxy, to find any planet that might even have a hint of life. And I can ram those probes into the planets if they pick up those signals. So he's saying, if a civilization grows to be really large, and if it's afraid of others that are going to come in and try to take it over or destroy it, then, you know, maybe this civilization just decides it really is important to just wipe everybody out. And so they build a bunch of probes, they send them out. You know, he said that if you make a probe weighing 100 tons, equivalent to a heavy-loaded freight vehicle, it can then use pushing lasers to get it up to 87% of the speed of light, where it now has kinetic energy equal to its mass energy. This is what we call a relativistic kill missile. And in this case, one which would have about 10 to the 22 joules of potential damage, or the equivalent force of a couple million megaton nukes. A couple million megaton nukes. The destructive force, hundreds of times the peak firepower during the Cold War. I can send that probe towards a habitable zone, pick up a star, give it just enough sensors and fuels to pick up any planet as it approaches and course corrects to ram it. I can also have it fragment beforehand to arrive in bits scattered all over the planet so the whole surface gets shotgunned. And of course, it's picking up detailed data before this and after this as it does it. So there are all these ways that civilizations out there could destroy. You know, and so what he does, and he comes back then as he summarizes some other points, and then he says, let's see. I'm just going to back up here a little bit. You really have to stretch belief to assume an otherwise peaceful species is going to go genocidal because you have colonized other planets when they have not even told you that they don't want you to do it. And so he's talking about the fact that there may be a huge civilization out there, but there's no way to say for sure that all of them are all going to be aggressive or all of them are all going to be peaceful. And if they haven't had any contact with them and you are stretching yourself out, you know, is it really likely they're just going to come and destroy you because you started to stretch yourself out when no one told you not to do that? So he said, when they have not even told you they don't want you to, if they're attacking over something like that or a diplomatic blunder with a full-scale escalation to genocide, then that was probably always their intent, and there's no reason to alter your own strategy. But they probably would have gotten themselves killed off for acting that way. So if they're naturally aggressive, they're probably going to be fighting among themselves, and that's probably going to be a problem. But they probably would have gotten themselves killed for acting that way or be worried about it, since if we're assuming one other advanced civilization is near us, we have to assume many others are fairly close too and might see what you're doing and disapprove, since they obviously don't espouse that approach themselves, or they have carried it out and you wouldn't be around to do it. And the keywords here are advanced civilizations. Such things would not generally arise without a modest understanding of cooperation, diplomacy, alliances, reciprocity, and deterrence. And so on, same as we have, since it's hard to build a civilization without them. I might say at this point, we seem to be lacking in as much cooperation, diplomacy, alliances, reciprocity, and deterrence as we used to have, but hopefully we will get back there. And he says, and that's a good final point, same as we have, because fundamentally, if Dark Forest works, we should see it play on Earth, and we don't. I'm not familiar with any civilization or species that's pursued this sort of strategy in our own forests. We as life, we as humans, we're explorers. We look around. The galaxy may be a dark forest, but it's not very likely there are predators stalking in its shadows, because fundamentally, if there were, they'd already have jumped out and eaten us by now. So that's fun. That came from a podcast. Credit where credit is due. Looking for the name of the guy. Because I thought he did a good job explaining this stuff. Where in the world? The Fermi. The video I was watching is called The Fermi Paradox, Dark Forest Theory. Isaac Arthur was the one that I was watching on YouTube. So, what do we make of all this? Well, the Dark Forest is just another attempt to explain away why we seem to be alone. Now then, it does not matter to my Christian belief, does not matter to my belief in Jesus, whether we are alone or not alone. It does not matter to me. But I think one possibility for why we seem to be alone is that we are alone. And one of the things that I have working in my belief system is that, in fact, our existence here is only a beginning. It is only the first inklings of what the universe will be. And there are things being decided here, and there is a bride of Christ being created here for Jesus. and then we will rule and reign with him, because the prophecy of Jesus is of his kingdom and the increase thereof, there shall be no end. And so I think what's really happening here is we're just getting some things decided. We're taking care of the problem of sin. You know, we're working out some things. We are being prepared for Christ, and we're having these experiences here on earth that we really should make the very best of. We should just make every day filled with moments, worthwhile moments, that have the imprimatur of his love and his kindness and his generosity, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of everyone we encounter. And then, once we have lived these lives here and enjoyed his presence here, the veil can be taken away, the shades can be dropped from our eyes, we can see him face to face, and we will know even as we are known. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.